Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. Well, it's been a crazy week at Cherry Bomb HQ. We're coming to you live today, and we just finished the next issue. We shipped it last night to the printer. It was a brutal few days getting that issue done, but it's with the printer now. It will be out on 11/13. I can tell you the theme. The theme is, you know what? I didn't even check. I forgot to proofread the side of the magazine. So I will call our printer as soon as the show is over. But I think it's supposed to say, yes, chef. And the theme is chefs and restaurants. So you can start to think about who maybe we put on the cover. It's a very exciting cover and somebody who's deserved to be on the cover for a long time. So we are thrilled about that. You also know we're planning Jubilee. The Jubilee Conference is in San Francisco on October 14th. A little nutty right now because we're just putting all the finishing touches on everything, talking to all the speakers, talking to all the people making the food. If you go to cherrybomb.com, you can check out the schedule and read some of the bios. And if you're coming, definitely come up and say hi. I would love to, just know who's listening to the show, know who's at the conference. It's a long day, so we'll have plenty of time to talk. And what else? Our book tour. Our book is out, 10-10, mark it down. Cherry Bomb the Cookbook. It's recipes from 100 plus of our favorite women. And it's hard to say our favorite women because literally every day I meet somebody else who could have been in the cookbook. And it's really painful that we had to limit it to just 100. So I don't know, maybe we'll have to talk to our publisher about this. I don't think this is their vision, but who knows? Maybe we can have volume after volume and just keep putting all our friends and all the special people that we meet in each subsequent edition. But our first event is tonight at The Wing in Manhattan. And then tomorrow is our first public event at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn. Fantastic bookstore. And then the book tour really kicks off. We'll be in Seattle on October 11th. At Book Larder, one of our favorite shops. And then we just kind of hit the ground running. We'll be in LA, we'll be in Nashville, Chicago, all over the place. You can check out the tour schedule also on cherrybomb.com. And some events are free and open to the public. Some you have to RSVP for, some you have to buy a ticket for. So take a look. But we hope if you are in one of the cities that we're coming to, we really, really would love to see you. So let's thank our sponsors because they help keep Radio Cherry Bomb on the air. This season is presented by Le Cordon Bleu. Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school, has locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from 9-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. And if you entered our Le Cordon Bleu sweepstakes and are wondering, was that a real contest? Did someone actually win that contest? The answer is yes. And we will. Thanks, Dave. The answer is we. And we will be naming the person who won very soon. Also, if you care about the food your pets eat, you need to know about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients from Castor and Pollux, the maker of America's number one organic pet food. It's purposeful pet food at its best. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. And don't forget, if you are taking pictures of your pet, tag us. Use the hashtag CherryBombPets. We want to see what kind of pets you guys have. And if you happen to have a dog or a puppy, we will be giving away a year's worth of Pristine pet food. So make sure to do that. A lot of you have, and it's been really fun seeing your pugs and your rescue dogs and all of that. All right, so we have these two amazing people in the studio right now, and I have a question for all of you. Do you smell good? We don't mean body odor. We mean your sense of smell. Chef Daniel Patterson and perfumer Mandy Aftel are authorities on fragrances, flavors, and aromas, and are here to share their wisdom. They are co-authors of the new book, The Art of Flavor, Practices and Principles for Creating Delicious Food, a compilation of recipes and great advice. Daniel is the Oakland-based award-winning chef, author, and restaurateur behind... I'm tired, Daniel. It's been a long... I know I'm going to... You do so many things. I know I'm going to leave some off. Alta Group's Alta at Midmarket, the newly opened Alta... How do you say it? Alta or Alta?
Alta.
Alta at Minnesota Street Project and several other Bay Area restaurants that we will talk about. He is also the co-founder of the revolutionary fast food venture Local. Mandy Aftel is an internationally known Berkeley-based artisan perfumer and award-winning author, most recently of Fragrant, The Secret Life of Scent. She's one of the world's foremost authorities on natural fragrances and recently opened, Mandy, can I mention this? Recently
Please.
Opened a by appointment only fragrance museum in Berkeley, right near Chez Panisse. Daniel and Mandy, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having us.
I don't know, does Daniel know that you and I have been friendly for 20 years?
Tell him.
So Mandy and I have known, and I've told the audience, Mandy and I have known each other for 20 years because I used to work in the beauty industry as a reporter, and Mandy has always been Mandy. So, you know, she was really the only person to talk to when it came to natural fragrances. So I would interview her every now and then and write about her company and her beautiful scents. So now it's so funny, two decades later, that we're both find ourselves in the food world. So it's been an exciting journey.
Oh, that's so great. And also that you both ended up being such pioneers in your own, your own field. So.
Thank you. And you too. All right. So I'm obsessed with your book. And I love that you two refer to yourselves in the book as two professionals who create sensual experiences for a living. And fragrance and food are pretty sexy, and I feel like we forget that sometimes. I know you two walk
yes.
around thinking, hey, I'm so sexy. I'm bringing a lot of sexiness to the food world.
That's the first thing I think about myself. That's right at the top of my list.
Too sexy for this food. Dave, can we... We can't sing, probably, right? I'm sure there's, like, a rule against that.
No rule, but I would prefer not.
Anyway, sorry, I'm being very silly. Anyway, we do forget the sensual side of food and fragrance. Why is that?
And so that's a great question. I think that... In this kind of modern world that we live in, we've become really removed from our humanness, and that goes into a lot of different areas. We communicate in a lot of ways that are distanced, and we don't talk to each other. We don't get into a situation where we're sharing a kind of emotional or kind of a loving and deeper connection. And cooking, the way that we smell, the way that we connect to each other through food and through fragrance, is one of the most human and most deeply felt ways that people get together. And I think that has a lot to... So the way that we've kind of gotten lost that through Instagram and all of the different ways that people connect with things that we eat and smell and taste, they've gotten so far removed from the actuality of it that I think that's really impacted like how we think about what this is at its core, which is a way of taking care of people.
That's such a great point that you bring up, because so many chefs are now focused on how things look because of Instagram more so than how things taste. Does that make you a little nuts as a chef?
I don't like rail against things I can't control, which is Instagram.
As soon as that came into my mouth, I was like, that's like owning a horse and being like, oh, I'm kind of pissed off they invented cars, you know?
I mean, it is to some degree, but also I think we all get to make choices about how we live and how we are in the world and what our values are and what's important to us. And that's one of the things that I really love about Mandy's work is itself, its integrity, what it is in the world, is its own kind of, and I wouldn't even say pushback against it, but to guard this thing that's really special in human existence, which is how we interact with the world around us through our sense of smell.
So Mandy, how did you and Daniel realize your kindred spirits?
Immediately. When I was, after I'd gone on a book tour for Essence and Alchemy, which was my first book on perfume, which is about four books back, I realized that people really either thought the perfume they were wearing was natural, or they just kind of hated perfume, a lot of people that found their way to me. And so I went to Eleanor Bertino, who was someone I knew as Alice Waters' roommate in college and knew Daniel, and I said to her, she's a person in the food world, could you recommend a chef? Because I thought, well, who's interested in ingredients? Of course, it's chefs that might be interested in, you know, what I'm doing. And the only person she mentioned was Daniel. So I met Daniel through Eleanor Bertino. And we just connected. We connected a long time ago. We wrote our first book, Aroma, about the magic of essential oils in food and fragrance. But we were talking, you know, in the last while, and it struck me when we would talk about our process, about how he created flavor and how I created perfume, that we were doing the exact same things. And that was very exciting to me, and I wanted us to write a book together.
It's interesting. I never really thought about, even though you and I have talked for years about how fragrances are created and the top notes and the middle notes and the base and all that, fragrances are really a recipe. And I never sort of put it together. I sort of had that aha moment on the subway over here. I was like, oh, you both deal in recipes at a fundamental level.
Yeah, it's cooking in a different way without substance.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's kind of disembodied flavor, what I do. And the whole idea of working with luscious, incredible materials and thinking how they can lock and fit together and what they do to each other in dynamic is really all that flavor is. And besides the fact that your food cooking is your home fragrance of your life. And so you can't escape the fragrant aspect of cooking. So it just seemed like a no-brainer to me, although it wasn't such a no-brainer when we sat down to try to write it. I mean, we really had an awfully hard time teasing out the concepts. It was really, really hard. You should speak to that. You're very good at that.
I was like, yeah, of course, write a book about flavor. How hard could it be? It was really hard. So it took a couple of years. But one of the things that came out of it, which in turn came out of a lot of Mandy's work, researching historical ways that people have approached not just flavor, but how scents interact with their lives through spirituality, through health, through all kinds of different things. The first chapter is really about what we call it, what is it, a biased history of scent?
A brief biased history of scent, thanks to Harold McGee.
Yeah.
He titled that chapter.
Yeah, because this is a little quirky, but what's really interesting, which I think Mandy can speak to better than I, is it's a very modern thing that the world of food and the world of scent have become separated. They used to be completely entwined, just the way, you know, if you go back to even as recently as the Middle Ages, the European cooking was heavy with use of spice. It was all thin, sweet, and sour sauces. There was nothing real. There was no distinction between dessert and savory food. They were all kind of mingled together. And so we forget how recent this development is, that we've become so removed. And it's almost like what happened was all of the natural scents were removed out of our life and replaced with kind of these artificial and very carefully placed replacements. And I think, you know, Mandy can speak to that history in a way that might bring kind of the magical aspect of it into like our consciousness in a way that it isn't normal.
So Mandy, just following on that, I don't know that people actually realize that so much of the fragrance in their lives is artificial.
Yes.
I think we should maybe start there.
Yes.
That whether it's a candle you burn or a body lotion you put on.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Well, you know, at the turn of the century, the last century, when they discovered how to create synthetic molecules from the natural ones, it really took off, and so did the fragrance industry. They took off together. And so there were many reasons to choose the synthetics over the naturals. So what they usually would do is harvest the narrative, the story, the selling document from the naturals, and then apply that to the synthetics because they were cheaper, because they were stable, and they were easier to work with. And so people who think, you know, who their body lotion or tea says it has Italian bergamot in, I mean, really right down to where it comes from, Italian bergamot or Indian jasmine and stuff, they kind of don't, because it's a very lucrative business with synthetics. And naturals, just like naturals and anything else, they're complex, they're interesting, they're quirky, they're hard to get, and they were not as profitable. So I think with the consumer, so much is what we see in food, too. The consumer is literally hungry for that kind of an experience of smelling something that's really wonderful, of getting an apple that's just really delicious. So we focus a lot in the book on shopping with your nose. Mm-hmm. Really, I mean, I can imagine that I would be banned in stores if our book was incredibly successful. I'm always urging people to smell everything, touch everything, stick your fingernail in the orange peel, you know, stick your fingernail in the clove, see if there's any oil there. Because many spices have been distilled and then they're sold, so there's no oil in them anymore. So they're not good to use. So the whole world of using natural materials, which I think people really crave and always have craved, is not so easy to get to.
You say in the book, shopping is the first step in cooking. And I think people forget that. Supermarket culture has definitely removed people from thinking of shopping as a great experience that's part of the whole process.
I think we wrote this book to address that in a way, in that we wanted to give people principles so they would no longer need a recipe. Larger principles that were quite simple that they could then apply to many things. So if you're in the supermarket and you're picking something like a potato, and you look at it and it's like a really good potato and interesting and small, little whatevers, you think about the facets of that flavor, you get something else that you're interested in, and you think about what you can do with those two things, how those two things will lock together and what they need. So Daniel had this incredible, brilliant idea when we were really stuck about the four rules of creating flavor, and it was just genius. And it applies, when you think about it, it's very simple, but it applies to everything. And we were thinking of what to do when you're in the market or looking in your refrigerator and there's just, you know, this awful, you know, way past its prime carrots and something else, like how to think about what you have. Inexpensive, simple to get, not fancy food.
Yeah, I mean, so like a big thing, so our book is written for home cooks. And it's the same principle that chefs use. But, you know, I think so many recipes books out there, and they'll tell you to pair lemon and basil, but they won't tell you why. And so those recipes are kind of, in a way, limiting, because they give you certain paths to get from one place to another, but they're very preordained. And if you end up in a place that you don't recognize, it's hard to figure out how to get to where you want to go or even know where you want to go. And so I think that, you know, one of the things we did was to try and create some sort of structure by which people could go from one thing to another in an easy and kind of sensible kind of way, to break it down into a less complex and overwhelming seeming thing. Because when you're in a market, there's so much there. How do you know what to choose? Mm-hmm. How do you know what's going to go with what? How do you know how to finish a dish? How do you know how to cook it? All of these things are kind of mysterious until you actually start doing them, in which point they become a lot less mysterious and a lot more familiar, and then they become just something that you do. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that Mandy just mentioned about the ingredients that's really important is to engage with the actual ingredients you have, not representative of carrot, but this really fresh, snappy, sweet, beautiful carrot that you want to shave raw, or this really kind of not very good storage carrot that's been sitting around for a while that you want to roast and create layers of flavor on, because the actual flavor you started with isn't as good as it could be. So the whole book is about how do you get to deliciousness wherever you find it.
You two did such a great job in The Art of Flavor. It's, even though this seems like a really, I mean, seems, it is a very weighty topic, you did such a beautiful job of explaining this for someone whose career is not cooking or making fragrances. So for any of you who are out there listening to this, who, if you really just love cooking and want to be a better home cook, like, this is such a good companion, literally, to every cookbook you have. And I would think of it not even as its own cookbook, because it's not. I would think of it as a companion to every other cookbook that you happen to own, or any other recipe that you
I want you to do the four rules.
I wrote them down. It's so funny. Because
they're so interesting.
You will take, when everybody goes out and buys this book, which you need to do today, you will write down so many notes from this book, because there are so many great nuggets of wisdom. And Mandy, I started writing down, when I was reading the book, all of that, the four directions of flavor. And I wrote them all down so we can go one by one. And the seven dials, all of that. But the four directions of flavor, rule one, similar ingredients need a contrasting flavor. What does that mean?
You do that one.
So it means basically that ingredients that share similar characteristics, let's say leeks and potatoes, make a very comforting and familiar and at the same time kind of uninteresting combination. So what they really need is something as a contrast, as a something to kind of set them apart. So maybe that's olive, maybe it's anchovy, maybe it's a bright herb. But the idea is that things, when they're very close together, need something to differentiate and make some complexity within that combination.
So if you come from a history of bland food, maybe your mom or your dad or whoever did the cooking in your house didn't quite understand rule one, huh?
Well, that gets to people's individual taste, which is another subject entirely.
Rule two, contrasting ingredients need a unifying flavor.
Yeah, so a lot of times, and I think one of the examples we put in the book that's kind of illustrative, that, and all the recipes are intended to be teaching recipes, even though they're easy to make and they're also good on their own terms, but carrots roasted in a bed of coffee beans, right? So when you have two ingredients that seem really, really far apart, you know, the question I always get as a chef is, how did you think of that? Like, how did you bring them together? And the answer is, on the one hand, things that you know suggest things that you don't know. So in other words...
Wait, I'm writing that down. Can you say that again? That's pretty deep. Things that you know...
suggest things that you don't know. So no one exists in a void. And no cook exists in a void. So the more that you cook and the more that you see that carrots go well with maybe a bitter or earthy foil, and maybe that's radicchio, maybe it's something else. And then you think, well, coffee is maybe just one step further in that place. But how do I bring them together? This way of that we describe as locking, when two very different ingredients make a third ingredient that's neither one nor the other, that becomes part of the cooking process. And so we get into that as we move on. But from an ingredient standpoint, if I was to talk about those two ingredients, I would say you need something bland and kind of comforting to bring them together. And maybe that's creme fraiche, or maybe that's some kind of sauce that's a little bit more, less of a demonstrative flavor. So maybe things that are very far apart, like, a great example is... blue cheese and bacon, but the date, if you take a date and you stuff it with blue cheese and wrap it in bacon and roast it, which
no
is very
kind of...
No one wants that. No one wants that. What's that salty, sweet...
I do.
That literally went in the book because of Mandy, yeah.
I like it.
I'm with you, Mandy.
I fought for that.
But it's also a great example of the date being sweet, comforting, accessible to both, and it becomes a bridge.
Can I say one thing while you're talking?
Yeah.
What he's talking about are the facets. So we talk a lot about flavor facets. That's a piece of what we kind of came up with this terminology. So if you listen to him talk, or you're thinking about, you know, two bland things, you know, in general, you're thinking about the character and the shape and the taste of something. And once you start to think, once your creative mind takes place that way, when you think of them that way, then you can put them together and have them lock together in a new way. And that's, I think that's underpinning the language, the thinking about facets of things and how those facets can create a new flavor, which is really what creating flavor is all about. Okay, you should go on to three.
All right, rule three, heavy flavors need a lifting flavor.
Yeah. So when something's like super heavy,
what's a heavy flavor?
To spark it. So imagine you have a beef stew, something like a gremolade on top. Some chili can spark it. Some bright herb, maybe acidity.
Okay. Rule four: light flavors need to be grounded.
Mm-hmm. So that's just the inverse. And so these are all four of my yin and yang kind of ideas that, you know, how do you create balance is really the question underneath all of them. And if things are too light, what that means is they have no staying power. They have no, it's like a person that really there's just not a lot there. You don't want to hang out with them. A dish is the same way. And sometimes all it needs is something grounding. And that could be a grain. It could be mushrooms. Or it could be something in the that's a little meatier and deeper. But where something feels too light, it just needs to be balanced. And so the whole book is really about how do you find harmony in cooking? And so all of these are different ways that happens. How do you respect the ingredient? How do you combine it with other ingredients in a way that's harmonious? And then how do you finish it at the end in a way that fine-tunes whatever the dish is, kind of the way you, if you have a song and you've recorded all the tracks, you have to finally mix it down in the end before it becomes what ultimately is something you want to hear.
And I feel like so much of this is intuitive, but for some reason, I think sometimes maybe it's just the fear factor in a kitchen, things like that. But I feel like, and I'm sure most of our listeners do, as you say all that, a lot of it is common sense.
Yeah, like those four rules, it's like you hear and you're like, well, of course, I can't believe you even put that in the book. It's so obvious.
But it's not until you sort of hear it.
Exactly, and that's the best kind of thing where it is obvious, but you just need to be told, and you're like, right, of course. And then once you kind of have this general idea, like, oh, all I'm really trying to do is create something balanced and harmonious, then all of the tools that we start building throughout the book become useful. A tool that is, you don't know what it's for, is not a very useful tool, but once you know what it's for, then all of a sudden, you have all of these different things, how you think about a cooking process, what you were bringing up, which was the four dials, which is,
your seven dials.
The flavor compass, which is mm-hmm. four directions of flavor, which are the most aromatic, most expressive part of any dish. It takes the least amount of real estate on the plate, but leaves the biggest impression. So that's citrus, spices, herbs, and flowers.
Things from my world.
I love that part.
The essential oil-rich components of flavor are from the world of perfume. So I know those ones very well and how transformative they can be. And whenever you use them, you're really in the presence of essential oils. You don't need to go buy a bottle. They're there in the basil leaf. They're there in the peel of the orange. All those essential oils, you're really just working with them. And so what we did in the flavor compass, we had those four areas, four different directions. But what we sought to do in there is, first when we started out, which was an incredibly interesting idea we had, is that nature is the original flavorist. And what we meant by nature is the original flavorist is that in nature, when you get an ingredient, like if you get an orange or a grapefruit, it's made up of many different aroma molecules. And those aroma molecules contribute to, say, what's the difference between a sweet orange and a blood orange, those different facets of it. And so nature puts together these amazing flavors all by itself. Like, that's what it does. It's not one, orange isn't one thing, it's many things. So when we cook, we're kind of copying what nature already does. They do that with those facets. And so what we sought to do on the flavor compass is to describe the differences between things that are close together. For example, the sweet spices, the cinnamon, the allspice, the clove, the nutmeg. People often say, just put in a sweet spice, or they're all interchangeable, but they're not. Nutmeg has a more woody facet. You know, clove is much more aggressive. There's a lot of sweetness in cinnamon. And then if you understand your way, if you understand these materials for their facets, then when you put cinnamon with, say, lemon, it's very different than if you're going to put nutmeg with lemon. So you can make a really fun, interesting choice and not just use them with a broad brushstroke.
So before we go to break, tell us about the seven dials, because I found that part of the book fascinating.
So those are the sweet, sour, salt, bitter, which are not flavors themselves, but sensations. So a lemon is sour, and vinegar is sour, but a lemon doesn't taste like vinegar. So there's been kind of in how we talk, the language about food, a lot of confusion about that. So these are actual sensations or qualities that the food has that interact with each other. And then so it's a sweet, sour, salt, bitter, there's umami. And then we added fat and heat, as in chili or spice heat. And then the idea is that you get to the end of the dish and you taste it. You taste it all the way through, but then you get to the end, and as you're tasting, you think it needs a little more acidity. Maybe the salt, which is a little bit high, you know that a little bit of lemon juice will bring that salt down. Maybe the acidity is a little low, and you know actually it needs salt to pull that up. How sweet interacts with bitter. how bitter interacts with umami, how the fact that if you have strong umami flavors, acidity can kind of diminish them. And then spices, how spices lock with chili heat to amplify. And so all of these things is, you get to the end and you're like, how do I want this to taste? And you're able to use these like little dials to fine tune it to your own sensibility. So what it's really about is putting your own fingerprint on your own food in whichever way you want. Because the thing about the book that we really wanted to do is not be too, we didn't want to give too much of an opinion of what people should cook, but for people to have a feeling that they could achieve whatever they wanted. And everyone has their own understanding of deliciousness. Everyone has a little bit of a different palate. And these are the tools that people can use to make things just the way they want.
The rules are so useful, like even just the sour rules. Sour pushes down salt, sweet, and bitter. If a dish is too salty, sweet, or bitter, acid can reduce the effect and provide balance. So I'm, you know, everybody oversalts something every now and then. What do you do in the kitchen? I mean, I know this is a super general question, but you can actually use an acid to make something taste less salty?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. The fact of the matter is that if you're a chef, you spend much of your time fixing things that went wrong. And I think that that's true of anything, because you have this idea and then maybe it doesn't go quite so well. Maybe you burn the bottom of the pot. So one of the questions is, can you just add a little bit of acidity? And then, or do you need to dilute it down? Or do you need to add a little fat, which pushes down the flavor? Or do you need to add a little bit of water or liquid or stock to open it up? So that's really what the dials are about, is not just how to perfect, but how to take something that didn't really end up quite the way you wanted it and to pull it back in alignment.
I also love that you have my favorite thing in all of Shakespeare in this book, in this section, where Cordelia says to her father in King Lear, "I love you as meat loves salt."
Oh, it's the best.
And I'm surprised more people don't say that to each other. Like, I love you as much as meat loves salt, because that really gets to that's love. 100%. But King Lear is also one of my favorite Shakespeare plays. Okay, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to hear about the two of you and how you both got on these journeys that brought you to where you are today. We will be right back with Mandy Aftel and Daniel Patterson, the authors of The Art of Flavor: Practices and Principles for Creating Delicious Food.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle Distel. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donnie Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made with ingredients like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do, and as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. We are here with Mandy Aftel and Daniel Patterson, two real treasures in the food world. I mean, you two are so creative and so wonderful, and we're very lucky to have you here today. So as I mentioned, I wanted to talk about how you actually got to where you are today and what got you on your career paths. And Mandy, Let's, you're looking at Daniel. Let's start with you. How did you, does this go back to your childhood? How did you know that you were blessed with an excellent nose and an excellent sense of smell?
It doesn't go back to my childhood. I kind of am a person without a plan. I think I may look more like I have a plan, but I don't have a plan. I sort of stumble along in my life. And I had a long career as a psychotherapist for artists and writers, and I wrote books. And then I kind of stumbled into making perfume.
How does one stumble into making perfume?
I stumbled into it because I had written a book about narrative and plot as a psychotherapist, because I was very interested, because when you're a therapist, people just tell you stories all day. So I like research. My very first book was on Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, and I did all the original oral research on him and the Rolling Stones. And so I like to dive deep into things. And so after I finished this book on plot and narrative, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to write a novel. And I do not know why. I thought I'd make my main character a perfumer. And so I started to do research, and I liked to collect books, and I knew perfume was synthetic. So I started to collect books from the turn of the century. And there was no kind of Google or anything like that. So I went to a lot of book fairs. I found all these books. I had a friend at the time, and she said, why don't we take a little class together? And we took this little class, and I loved the materials. It was kind of like love at first sight. I thought they were like worlds, the essential oils and the flowers and the spices and the roots and the barks. I kind of loved it all. I made a perfume. She said, let's start a perfume line, which we did. And I made the perfumes, and she did the business, and it fell apart pretty quickly. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm terrible at this. I shouldn't ever be in business again. So my friend, my best friend, who is the publisher of this book and publisher of many of my books, editor, publisher, whatever it's called, editor, she said, why don't you write a book for me on perfume? So I wrote a book called Essence and Alchemy about 20-some years ago that was pretty widely published and kind of has been credited some for starting artisanal perfumery and certainly natural perfumery. And I went on, and I very slowly... And then I met Daniel because people said the stuff about perfume, so I wanted to work with a chef and explain the ingredients. And then I very slowly put together the things that I do now, which is I have a small, very small artisanal perfume line. I work with chefs. I have a line of chef's essences. I work with a lot of small purveyors of ice cream and drinks and people who make booze and restaurants and chocolate makers, supplying them with flavor. And I teach. And then I have this little tiny, strange, little tiny, wonderful museum that I opened 2 months ago. And I've gotten, I think, where I am because I am very passionate and very singular. I'm the kind of person who really, really likes something and doesn't like the rest. So I just stay right on the track of what I like. It's not hard.
You are an original, 100%. The museum, how can people get tickets to the museum?
Oh, goody. I love my museum. It's open on Saturdays, and if you go to my website, it says museum on it, or you can go to www.aftelier.com/archive, and you can read about it and see the pictures. We're only open on Saturday. You get a ticket, and you can come for an hour, and we have really the history of the natural materials in the world. It's not about the finished products of perfumes. We have all the animal ingredients. We have an organ where you can smell all the essences. We have 200 and some essences, and we have a lot of historical artifacts and hand-tinted postcards and engravings, and it's just really a learning and fun experience. And you also can see all the raw materials, like the real tonka beans and frankincense incense, and
mind-blowing place.
It's really great. It's really like nothing you've ever seen. There's no referent for it.
I got to visit Mandy in her beautiful house and go to the museum, and you've got books that are hundreds of, not just old, like hundreds of years old.
Many.
All these incredible fragrance, natural fragrance collections you bought from
Attics
France
in Paris.
that are over 100 years old. I mean, this really is a treat. It's a small museum. It's not like you're going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but, and is it only open when you are there?
It's only open on Saturday. It's open from 10 to 6 on Saturday.
But you're there when people come.
I'm there most of the time when people come. But we, my husband's son, Devin, runs it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's always there when it's open.
Okay, great. And if you are visiting the Bay Area or live in the Bay Area, it is a wonderful sort of like afternoon trip, day trip. Go to the museum. You can go to Chez Panisse. You can walk around Berkeley and see all the beautiful homes and all those beautiful front yards. Berkeley blows my mind every time I go there.
A lot of people do come or go from Chez Panisse to the museum.
Walking distance.
It's around the block, and it's very nice. I'm very lucky.
Okay, but I still have a hard time believing that there wasn't some little thing where you, when you look back, you're like, oh yeah, I always had a good nose. Like, I just always had a more heightened sense of smell than the kids around me or my family. No, nothing? Daniel, you're with me? There has to be something.
Well, that's the thing about humans. It doesn't have to be anything. We're kind of like easy to understand and yet impossible to explain.
So there were no scent clues before you took that class and wrote that novel?
You know, I kind of had not such an easy time. And to me, it's a miracle that I've ended up where I am. I wasn't, you know, number one in my class. I wasn't the highest achieving person. And I think it's just terrific how life's worked out for me. I just feel amazed.
Daniel, your turn. How did this journey start for you?
That's a great question. I want to say, though, about that museum, which I don't think it's really, if you're just listening or kind of thinking about it. I mean, I know Mandy. I watched this thing being built, and I was like, you know, whatever, I'll go to your museum. It'll be fine. It blew me away. It was so impactful in the way that a short story, if it's well-written, if it hits universal themes and just turns things around so you see the world in a new way, that's what it's like. And that's what I love about Mandy, is she sees the world in a different way, and I think that that is what ultimately has been has animated everything within her world, is that she just has an original way of looking at things. And I think that that's something about people that's the thing you can't reduce down to any explanation. My story is pretty simple. I started working in kitchens when I was 14, washing dishes. And
Did you grow up?
I grew up in Massachusetts. Forgot to get a real job. And then one day I woke up and it was the only thing I knew how to do. And I was... And then that was that.
How did you wind up in the Bay Area?
I moved out in 1989. I was pretty young. And I just, I wanted to go somewhere. I didn't know where I wanted to go. I knew one person. So I just packed up some bags and I got on a plane with no return ticket. And that was that.
What was your first job out there?
Let's see. I worked in a restaurant that... No, the first job I had was in retail, and it lasted about 6 months. And it was great because I met someone in a really famous local band that had just broken up called Operation IV. And he introduced me to Gilman Street and the local punk scene, and that was, like, amazing. And that was the best thing about this job that I had, and everything else was kind of not so great. It was, I can't remember, a place that doesn't exist anymore. And then I took a job in a restaurant at another place in a hotel that doesn't exist anymore. But that became like kind of a jumping off point to figure out that this was really my passion. And having 6 months of doing something else made me realize that what I really love to do is cook.
When did you know you wanted to be a chef?
Maybe when I was like 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. I tried to go to college for a year. Didn't go so well, either for the school or for me. I was working full time while I was in school, and I realized I was gonna have to make a decision. Like I couldn't do both, and that was what I really wanted to do, was to see what would happen if I kept cooking. You know, at that point I was, you know, 5 years in, and I didn't have very much experience. I wasn't what I would call in any way a good cook, but I just noticed that I could make things taste good, and that seems like a really like an insignificant thing, but the chef at the time called me an idiot savant. Sometimes they just call me an idiot, but but you know, it's just like I would kind of stumble into something and I'd hand it to them and they'd be like, what did you do? And so I love the culture, I love the people, and because food is about people, and we I think sometimes in the food world, in the media world, we tend to lose sight of that. And that was always the thing that really was the most powerful and meaningful thing for me about cooking, was the way of connecting to people in this really emotional way of taking care of them and of communicating in a language that that everyone understands.
So for people who want to spend that Saturday and go to Mandy's Museum and then come back to San Francisco and go to one of your restaurants, tell us about your places.
There's a pretty big range. So the restaurant that's probably best known and where I was a chef for 10 years is called Qua. And that's a 2 Michelin star restaurant. And, you know, Qua was one of those restaurants, kind of like Mandy, I just kind of more or less stumbled through life and made decisions that really didn't make a whole lot of sense except to me. And so when I opened Qua, it was it's right next to a strip club. It's not in a part of town that's associated with fine dining. And we opened in 2006 at a time when there really was no fine dining in San Francisco. We opened with a tasting menu. There was only one menu. It's very expensive. And we combined a lot of things that really didn't fit: handmade pottery and mostly vegetable menus, a lot of wild ingredients. And basically everyone called me who I knew in the industry to tell me that we were going to fail and it was a terrible idea. I look back and I think, yeah, they weren't wrong. But somehow we made it. And because of that, it, I think, created a new business model and a new way of thinking that this can be a restaurant. So it gave people a lot of confidence to follow their own dreams. And I think that was kind of the best thing about it. And at somewhere down the line, I thought that I should probably think about making money. We had a kid, and my wife said, "Are you going to make money at some point?" And I thought, I'll just open another restaurant, without remembering that the reason I had no money in the first place is because I opened a restaurant. And so then,
I've heard that story before.
So I kept opening restaurants, thinking that eventually I was going to figure that out. And so what happened was I finally decided to kind of organize everything, because I wanted to call ourselves the Accidental Restaurant Group, but I was dissuaded. There was one restaurant in particular called Alta that we opened about 4 years ago. And it's a great neighborhood restaurant, really fun vibe, place where everyone feels comfortable, really good drinks, really good food, not too expensive. And I thought, well, this is something that we can use to really grow. So right now we have 2 locations. With another one coming in January. We'll open in a hotel called The Grant, and then one in Los Angeles in the West Adams community. We have a 90-year-old steakhouse called Alfred's that we bought a couple of years ago, which is a classic, beautiful, amazing steakhouse. There's a bar in Oakland called Plum Bar, and then I have a different project with a chef from Los Angeles, Roy Choi, who is an incredible visionary and really beautiful person. And it's a very simple idea. It's like, let's go to places where there isn't a lot of good food, and let's cook good food, let's hire people, let's train them.
And that project's called Local.
And that's called Local. Mm-hmm. And that's been amazing and like one of the most beautiful things I've ever done in food.
We could easily spend a whole show talking about Local. So I would love to right now invite you back anytime to come talk about Local, because we've followed it from the beginning and are big fans of what you and Roy are doing, and it would be amazing. I know everyone probably wants you to bring a local to their city, but do you have plans to come out east?
Yeah, we're working on it. You know, it takes time to kind of figure out like the best way to do everything, and so we're working on all of that. We, you know, normally like you'd open a restaurant quietly and you'd work on it for a couple of years and then you start kind of growing it, and we just did it all backwards and did it under a microscope. And but yeah, our plans are like, once we get our feet under us, maybe starting next year, we'll start looking at expansion.
Well, I really understand more why you two are kindred spirits now.
We are kindred spirits.
Yes.
For a long time.
So, Mandy, people might not realize this, but you are speaking at the Jubilee Conference. You are giving a talk that may or may not be titled How to Smell. I feel like we forced you into that title, but it's going to be great. Do you want to give people a little preview of what you'll be talking about?
Well, you mean like what I'm going to actually say?
Sure, like go for it.
Well, I think that what's most important when you when you smell is the very first thing, I think, is to close your eyes. Like you do if you kiss someone you really want to kiss. Like really, like do it with that level of passion and intentionality. And most people, when they really smell, when they're really there for it, it's not some sideline, they do close their eyes. It's a lot like kissing. You close your eyes and you really just take in everything that you're smelling. And if you can't figure out the words for it, it's great if you find your own, if you can't figure out the words for it, but to pay attention to the kind of complexity and aliveness and kind of aromatic experience you're having, and that is so connected to who you are kind of as an animal being, and to really have that. And I think it's very kind of sensual and sexual and enlivens everything around you. So if you're, I'm very big on if you're, you know, you're in the store to kind of, you know, smell everything and rip things up and like basil leaves or mint leaves and compare them, or if you see a rose in the garden to crush it and to take that moment to stop time and to really smell what's around you, and there's a wealth of information and beauty for you. So that's what I think.
Well, I think we've come full circle. Like I said in the beginning, you two are putting the sexy back in food. So thank you on behalf of all of us for doing that. All right, everybody, that's it for today's show. Mandy, we'll see you
soon
in a week and a half. Daniel, I hope we see you again soon. And don't forget, be sure to check out their book, The Art of Flavor, Practices and Principles for Creating Delicious Food. It is out now. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tatasciore, and much love to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you are a devoted pet parent, be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. And as always, we'd like to say a big thank you, or merci, I should say, to Le Cordon Bleu. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary culinary school. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
And I'm part of Tabletop, a consortium that brings together different artists, illustrators, zine makers, and comic artists all about food. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Mallory Kayon, the executive sous chef at Sunday in Brooklyn and Williamsburg.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.